This is VOA News, reporting by remote. I'm Joe Ramsey. The U.S. Justice Department said Sunday it will review the law enforcement response to the shooting in Uvalde, Texas, that left 19 students and two teachers dead. The review comes amid mounting pressure and questions about the shifting and at times contradictory information of what happened in the shooting last Tuesday at Robb Elementary School and how police responded. A Justice Department spokesman says the review will be conducted in a fair, impartial, and independent manner, and that the findings would be made public. Authorities revealed on Friday students and teachers repeatedly begged 911 operators for help, even as a police commander told more than a dozen officers to wait in a school hallway. Talks on potential modest compromises on U.S. gun safety legislation continue. AP correspondent Shelley Adler reports.
My hope is that this time is different.
Senator Chris Murphy, a Democrat from Connecticut, who is part of the bipartisan group of senators in talks about gun safety legislation.
I am at the table in a more significant way right now with Republicans and Democrats than ever before. Certainly many more Republicans willing to talk right now than were willing to talk after Sandy Hook.
A different point of view from GOP Congressman Mo Brooks from Alabama.
What we have to do is stop the motivation that causes these criminals, these horrific individuals, to do what they do.
While Brooks was on Fox News Sunday, Murphy appeared on ABC's This Week with George Stephanopoulos. I'm Shelley Antler.
U.S. President Joe Biden flew to the Texas town of Uvalde on Sunday to comfort families ripped apart by the worst American school shooting in a decade as the public demands answers about why local police failed to act swiftly. Biden will meet with victims, families, survivors, and first responders, attend a church service, and visit a memorial at Robb Elementary. This is VOA News. Thousands of Israeli nationalists, some of them chanting "Death to Arabs," have begun parading through the heart of the main Palestinian thoroughfare in Jerusalem's Old City. Sunday's march was a show of force that risked setting off a new wave of violence in the tent city. The crowds, who were overwhelmingly young Orthodox Jewish men, were celebrating Jerusalem Day, an Israeli holiday that marks the capture of the Old City in the 1967 Mideast War. Palestinians see the event, which passes through the heart of the Muslim quarter, as a provocation. Last year, the parade helped trigger an 11-day war with Gaza militants, and this year's march drew condemnations from the Palestinians and neighboring Jordan. Ukrainian forces endured heavy artillery barrages on Sunday as they held off Russian attempts to capture the largest city Kiev still controls in the Luhansk region of the Donbas, Ukrainian officials said. The shelling was so intense it was not possible to assess casualties and damage, according to the governor of Luhansk. Dozens of buildings have been destroyed in the past few days. The Ukrainian government, meanwhile, urged the West to provide it with more longer-range weapons to turn the tide in the war, now in its fourth month. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky visited Ukrainian troops on the front lines in the northeastern Kharkiv region on Sunday. The trip marked his first official appearance outside Kiev region since Russian President Vladimir Putin launched the invasion on February 24th. Ukrainian troops pushed Russian forces back around Kharkiv earlier this month, but the city has come under renewed artillery fire this week. Colombians are emerging from the pandemic to find increasing inequality, inflation, and violence, and they're picking their next president Sunday from a pool of six men who are all promising various degrees of change amid a generalized sense that the country is headed in the wrong direction. The ballot includes a former rebel who could become the first country's leftist head of state. The contest also features a populist real estate tycoon who promises rewards for tips on corrupt officials and a right-wing candidate who has tried to distance himself from the widely disliked conservative current president, Iván Duque. Recapping our top story, the U.S. Justice Department said Sunday it will review the law enforcement response to the shooting in Uvalde, Texas, that left 19 students and two teachers dead. The review comes amid mounting pressure and questions about the shifting and at times contradictory information of what happened in the shooting last Tuesday at Robb Elementary School and how police responded. A spokesman said it will be conducted in a fair, impartial, and independent manner, and that the findings would be made public. Reporting by remote, I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
Today, we haven't had that. I mean, not to say, I'm not in the business of, you know, trying to suggest that everything is fine. It's not. I would why I acknowledge that things are not, you know, I mean, where it should be. But to suggest that, you know, the government is not, you know, on top of this situation, I think is also not fair, because they are.
Nigeria's ruling All Progressive Congress, or APC, postpones the contest to choose a presidential candidate from May 29th to June 6th.
That jurisdiction has agreed to the extradition, then we'll be able to get them back into the country and possibly formally charge them and formally deal with the matter. But currently, warrants for their arrest have been issued in South Africa.
South Africa's National Prosecuting Authority, or NPA, steps up its fight to root out corruption in the country.
Corrupt judges we have currently who are offering these unnecessary acquittal to the people who plundered the state. These people are found with properties they cannot justify, but they are always being given favorable outcomes. That is what is worrying us in the fight against corruption.
And the Community Action Against Corruption calls on government agencies to weed out the menace of graft in Zambia. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. In Nigeria, the contest to choose a presidential candidate for the ruling All Progressive Congress, or APC, has been postponed from May 29 to June 6. Officials say 21 presidential aspirants have so far announced plans to contest in the primaries to become the designated candidate for the party. The aspirants included incumbent Vice President Yemi Osinbajo, APC leader and former Lagos State Governor Bola Ahmed Tinubu, Transport Minister Rotimi Amaechi, and Yahaya Bello, the governor of Central Kogi State. The primaries come as the electoral law demands all political parties to present the names of their respective presidential candidate and running mates by June 3. The winner of the contest is expected to face stiff competition from the candidate of the main opposition People's Democratic Party, or PDP. Analysts say due to the ongoing sharp increase in insecurity and economic challenges facing the country, the PDP's candidate can win next year's presidential election. For the latest development, I reach barrister Felix Morka. He is the National Publicity Secretary of the ruling APC.
For weeks and months, we've been preparing for that event, which will be the culmination of all of the activities that we have been implementing to select and elect those who fly the party's flag in the next general election. And so the presidential convention, which is scheduled to begin on Sunday through Monday, at which the presidential candidate of our party will be elected by delegates to that convention.
Barrister Felix, some people are saying that your party, the APC, appears to show its financial muscle with the exorbitant presidential nomination fees. Your response to that?
Peter, I mean, this is very expensive business. For example, today, we're moving committee members who are conducting these primaries, who are supervising and ensuring that the, you know, activity goes well and is conducted in accordance with the Electoral Act and the Constitution of the country. We're moving them around today, flying them from one, you know, place to the other, and, you know, also making arrangements for them to leave and stay in hotels in order to do their assignments. I mean, it costs money. The election itself costs money. There's a lot of issues around security that the party pays for. And, you know, Peter, I think in our last conversation, I did explain that some of this money that is that was received as, you know, fees, funds, which has generated a lot of interest, you know, in the public space, is also given back to the candidates to support them during their election.
So, Barrister, how confident are you that the candidate that is elected to represent your party will maintain power come 2023 in the general election?
We are very confident, Peter. The current government, under President Muhammadu Buhari, the APC-led government, has done an incredible amount of work to create and build a legacy that I think, you know, we believe the electorate will support with their vote, you know, at the next election.
But what do you say to critics who say that the party and its presidential candidates and its leadership have failed to resolve the myriad of challenges Nigerians face, including, they said, the worsening security situation in the country, because this is not how it used to be. And that kidnapping is on the rise, insecurity is on the rise, people can afford 3 square meals a day, among other issues. How do you respond to them?
There's no question. I mean, as a citizen of Nigeria, I am very concerned about the level of insecurity in the country. That is for sure. The government itself is very mindful of that, but are working hard, you know, using all of the instruments and resources at its disposal to combat insecurity, whether it's at the level of kidnapping or banditry or terror. The government is working hard. Peter, you know, there was a time when, you know, the headlines around insecurity was about the lack of resources, lack of, you know, meaningful allocation of resources to all of our security platforms. There was a time when it was that, you know, even soldiers and other security, you know, forces don't get paid, you know, their entitlement or are abandoned in the field without, you know, proper material and proper cover. Now, you know, I am sure you will agree that those headlines are no longer there. They have disappeared. So the question right now is not whether this government has is putting its resources where its mouth is or actually doing its best to mobilize, you know, support for its armed forces. The issue now is about the tactics of evil, the strategy that these armed groups and bandits have evolved. You know, as you know, this is asymmetric warfare. It's not your conventional warfare. But I think what matters, the headline should be what the government is doing. And my case here is that the government is doing a whole lot to bring this in. And quite frankly, a time was when some of us could not go to Abuja and actually walk the streets, you know, under the watch of the former, you know, government of the People's Democratic Party. Bombs were going off every day in the federal capital territory. But today, we haven't had that. I mean, not to say, I'm not in the business of, you know, trying to suggest that everything is fine. It's not. And which is why I acknowledge that things are not, you know, I mean, where it should be. But to suggest that, you know, the government is not, you know, on top of this situation, I think is also not fair, because they are.
Barrister Felix Morka is the National Publicity Secretary of Nigeria's ruling APC. He spoke with me from the capital, Abuja. In South Africa, the National Prosecuting Authority, or NPA, says it has stepped up its fight to root out corruption in the country. This after top former employees of Transnet, the state rail and port operator, were charged with fraud and money laundering. The officials, including Siyabonga Gama, a former group chief executive, Gary Peter, a former acting group chief financial officer, Pitolo Ramusebudi, former group treasurer, Eric Wood, regiment shareholder, and Daniel Roy, the current director of assets management. They were all granted bail. The investigating directorate of the NPA says it will hold accountable those responsible for corruption, as well as those who are alleged by ongoing investigation to have taken part in high-level graft known in South Africa as state capture. For more on the fight against corruption, I reached Cindy Siwe Seboga. She is spokesperson for the Investigating Directorate of South Africa's National Prosecuting Authority.
Certainly, the NPA has intensified its fight against corruption. NDPP Shamila Batoi, as well as Advocate Andrea Johnson, the Investigating Directorate head, committed to Parliament that you would be able to enroll a variety or several seminal matters or priority matters in the fight against state capture after the State Capture Commission issued its recommendations. What is of high importance is the fact that this year already we've been able to get the preservation order, meaning we've been able to get under the state control a mine called Optimum Coal Mine situated in Mpumalanga, which is a province in South Africa, valued at over 3 billion. However, through assessments, we are anticipating that through evaluation, it could be worth over 8 billion. So the NPA is working hard to make sure that more and more matters are further enrolled this week alone. From Monday, we've enrolled about three cases, as well as two other business associates or businesses, rather, basically partook in the using of funds for rehabilitation of a mine, which is in breach of one of our regulations in the country. They used that particular money for something which was untoward.
Cindy Sewe, in the fight against corruption in South Africa, what would you say has been the successes so far?
The successes would definitely have to be obviously the preservation of the optimum coal mine of about $3 billion. That happened this year. Secondly, it would have to be the Interpol red notices that have been issued against two of the Gupta brothers. In total, of the eight that we requested accused in the Nulani 24.9 million matter, about six we got red notices of which two of the Guptas and four others are of Indian national descent and are persons who we are alleging were pivotal in order to facilitate money laundering in that particular matter. So I think for us, those are two main successes currently. The arrest that took place this Friday in terms of Transnet, because Transnet was one of those state-owned entities that has been brought to its knees through corruption. So the enrollment of this 93.4 million case is another big highlight.
What would you say is the way forward, as you see it from the NPA's perspective?
The way forward would to ensure that we keep the commitments made by our top leadership by enrolling more matters, high-profile matters, onto the court roll. Secondly, it would be to ensure that more and more effort is put into recouping, either through restraint orders, making sure that assets are not dissipated, or through preservation orders, making sure that that process goes as speedily as reasonably possible to ensure the forfeiture and sale of those assets in order to recoup as much money as possible that was looted through the state capture era back into the fiscus. That is the more logical way forward for the NPA.
Some South Africans have been asking what happened to the case involving the Guptas.
The NPA has not abandoned its fight to get back the Gupta brothers to our account in our country. They are currently fugitives. South Africa has requested that Interpol red notices be issued against them. Interpol has agreed, and the Interpol red notices were issued as early as February this year. What has since transpired is that Interpol is currently busy disseminating the various red notices to its various member states across the world. Once they have been spotted and or located, they shall be detained, and then South Africa will then be able to liaise with whatever jurisdiction or country that they're found in order to try our best to get them back into the country. You'd know that each and every country is sovereign in its own right, and we cannot impose ourselves in those particular countries. However, Interpol is assisting us with its various member states. Once that has been concluded, and once we've been able to locate and send an extradition, and once that jurisdiction has agreed to the extradition, then we'll be able to get them back into the country and possibly formally charge them and formally deal with the matter. But currently, warrants for their arrest have been issued in South Africa.
Cindy Sewe Seboka is spokesperson for the Investigating Directorate of South Africa's National Prosecuting Authority. She spoke with me from the capital, Pretoria. In Zambia, the group called Community Action Against Corruption is calling on state institutions mandated to fight graft to weed out the menace in the southern African country. The group says the lack of successful prosecution of high-level corruption is demoralizing, which it further states undermines efforts of the new government to fight graft. Their remarks come after former senior government officials accused of corruption won their cases in court. Their supporters say this shows the independence of the judiciary. They also say the accusations appear to be politically motivated to tarnish the reputation of the former administration officials. But Community Action Against Corruption says anti-graft agencies should do more, following a commitment by President Hakainde Hichilema to fight graft transparently and in accordance with the law. For more on the latest developments in the fight against fraud and mismanagement, I reach Brighton Tembo. He is the chief executive officer of the Community Action Against Corruption.
There is the confusion in the fight against corruption due to the fact that the office of the DPP and the Anti-Corruption Commission and the judiciary, these people are not coordinating well. Hence, there are the high-profile cases involving those people who plundered the nation are resulting into acquittal or bizarre non prosequi. So there is no coordination between the Anti-Corruption Commission, the judiciary, and the Office of the Director of Public Prosecution. That is our predicament. These people are not coordinating well.
Is this because of the recent acquittal of former ministers who are accused of plundering the state through corruption?
Not necessarily that, Peter, because if you look at all the cases that have been unearthed and taken to court, all the cases, as long as they are high-profile cases, they are ending up in disappointment. No any high-profile case has resulted into anything that we can call a conviction or tangible. All the cases are just collapsing like that. So this is a source of worry to many of us who are involved in corruption fight, as well as the general citizenship. People are worried, why are these cases collapsing? It means there is too much incompetence in the way the Anti-Corruption Commission is conducting itself. There is also some degree of incompetence in the Office of the Director of Public Prosecution, which is now resulting into cases failing to proceed in any meaningful manner. So far, we've not recorded any meaningful result concerning those people who plundered the state, despite the new government giving political will and not interfering in the work of the Anti-Corruption Commission like the way it was in the past.
But Brighton, your organization is also very critical about the judiciary. What can the judiciary do? Because you prove your case in court. Why should the judiciary be criticized for doing its job?
Yeah, you know, Peter, the judiciary is not being criticized. Already here in Zambia, for example, just three weeks ago, two judges from our major state courts, one was fired, the other one was suspended because of corruption. So we cannot even respect the outcome of such courts where the judges themselves are involved in corruption. That is our problem, Peter.
Brighton, what does your organization think is the way forward in the fight against corruption in Zambia?
As the Community Action Against Corruption, Peter, what we are calling upon the new Don government to make sure that they restructure the judiciary, because the judiciary has remnants of those people who were appointed by the previous regime. And if you look at our judiciary in the previous regime, the judiciary was organized to favor the previous regime. So new government should reorganize the judiciary. They have to reorganize the director of the Office of the Director of Public Prosecution, as well as organizing the Anti-Corruption Commission. Because if these three offices are not reorganized, we are going to be going through the same thing without proper outcomes. So there is a need to make radical changes in the judiciary, radical changes in the Office of the Director of Public Prosecution, radical changes at the Anti-Corruption Commission. That way, we're going to have the way forward.
Don't you think if this reorganization is done, people would say the government is tipping the scale of justice and that the government plans to go after its perceived political opponents or enemies in Zambia?
It's constitutional for the government to reorganize the Anti-Corruption. If there are those people are proving to be incompetent, like the case which just collapsed over, a high-profile government official, they went to seize his properties. They announced to the state to say they have seized the properties, but just to go to court, and they were told that the procedure was not followed. If the judiciary is competent enough, it is not corrupt, anyone who is taken there, if the case comes out with the reality of fairness, no one will complain. We know when a person is taken to court, there are two results that can come out of the court. There is acquittal or conviction. So what we don't want are these corrupt judges we have currently who are offering these unnecessary acquittal to the people who plundered the state. These people are found with properties they cannot justify, but they are always being given favorable outcomes. That is what is worrying us in the fight against corruption and the government as well.
Brighton Tembo is the chief executive officer of the Community Action Against Corruption. He spoke with me from the Zambian capital, Lusaka. Some youths in northern Kenya are abandoning banditry for alternative ways of earning a living. More than 500 men from the Samburu indigenous group, traditionally known as Mura, are enrolled in vocational training such as carpentry, keeping them from what authorities say is the smuggling of guns from neighboring Ethiopia for cattle rustling. For VOA, Victoria Munga reports from Samburu, Kenya.
28-year-old Simon Lempramarai recalls the day in 2019 when he and a friend were nearly shot after stealing cattle from a rival community in Samburu. He says, "We went for a raid. We went to steal. Before we got to our destination, they ambushed us. They shot at us. We ran. Each one went their way. We had to save our lives. I was on my own and there was no hospital around. I decided that I don't want to do this anymore." Simon, now a motorcycle repairman in his village, says he enrolled in vocational training for a decent livelihood. He's among more than 500 youths in northern Kenya taking part in what is known as Ujuzi Manyatani, meaning skills in the community in Swahili. Authorities say the program is helping to diversify livelihoods among young Murans, including women. Program director Boru Ture explains.
This is a program that is being fashioned that it suits the pastoralist lifestyle, because the tools and the trainers are actually mobile. They move from one village to another. Through this program, a number of youth and women who were previously engaged in unproductive activities such as banditry, highway robbery, are now turning their skills into businesses.
National data indicates northern Kenya regions plagued by arid weather, sparse population and pastoral activities have the highest unemployment with rates of up to 62%. Kenyan government spokesperson Cyrus Oguna told VOA in a phone interview that the state is supporting the education of northern communities, especially against the traditional cattle rustling practice.
Sometimes they rustle either to take dowry, sometimes they rustle for economic reasons. So the government, you know, strategy is to educate most of these people so that rustling, you know, as a practice, a cultural practice, is something that is actually completely abandoned and done away with. That's new ways of doing things, ways of, you know, looking at social issues, you know, are introduced to them through education.
Community elders like Purandi Lenegwanai, who are leading peace talks involving rival groups in the region, say the vocational training can be a real shot in the arm if more youths become involved. The elder says they are repairing motorbikes and making some money. Their mindsets has changed from rustling, but those who are not trained are still in the bush practicing the vice. Dozens of people in northern Kenya lose their lives to ethnic rivalry, according to security authorities. Officials have voiced hope that initiatives such as job skills training will help to stop the crimes in the future. Victoria Amunga for VOA News, Samburu, Kenya.
Hello. Hello, I'm Carol Castiel. As we honor Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month, we talk with Congresswoman Judy Chu, a Democrat from the state of California and the first Chinese American to be elected to Congress. We will speak with Judy Chu about contributions of Chinese Americans to the United States and her championing of legislation against racially motivated hate crimes in America. That's Press Conference USA this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
It's The Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Mpuga, and that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs and Music from our African collection. But first, U.S. Monastir of Tunisia topped Petro de Luanda of Angola 83-72 on Saturday evening to win the Men's Basketball Africa League title in Kigali, Rwanda. VOA Sunny Young reports from the Rwandan capital, Kigali.
Monastir rallied from a seven-point halftime deficit, outscoring Petro by 5 points in the third quarter, and then pulling away in the fourth quarter when they tallied 26 points to 13 for the Angolan club. American guard Michael Dixon and Tunisian forward Firas Layani led Monastir with 21 points each. Dixon was named the Basketball Africa League's most valuable player. Lukeni Goncalves scored a game-high 28 points for Petro. Meanwhile, Sudan-born big man Otter James Majok scored 14 points, had 4 rebounds, and blocked 1 shot for Monastir. Majok won the Dikembe Mutombo Defensive Player of the Year award. For his part, Basketball Hall of Famer Mutombo sat courtside for the Monastir Petro final, which was played in front of a near-capacity crowd at the BK Arena here in Kigali. Monastir's Ivorian international Suleiman Diabate scored 4 points and also had 3 rebounds and 3 assists. Diabate is the first 2-time BAL champion. He played for 2021 winner Zamalek, which beat FAP of Cameroon on Friday night in the third-place game. The Basketball Africa League says it's committed to gender equity. One sign of that on Saturday evening was the Mexican female referee, Hortensia Sanchez Carrizales, one of 3 refs on the court. The 2023 Basketball Africa League final will also be played here in Kigali. I'm VOA's Sonny Young in Kigali, Rwanda.
It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Mpuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. Let's start at the European Champions League, where Real Madrid became European champion for a record 14th time after beating England's Liverpool 1-0 in the Champions League final at the Stade de France in Paris on Saturday. The game started 37 minutes late because of disturbing crowd issues outside the stadium. UEFA, in a press statement, blamed the chaos on people trying to get into the stadium without legitimate tickets, without providing details on where they could be from. While Madrid completed the Champions League La Liga double, Liverpool finished a season that promised so much with just 2 domestic cups in England. Meanwhile, the 2021-2022 CAF Champions League final between Al Ahly of Egypt and Wydad SC of Morocco will be held on Monday, May 30th at the Mohamed V Stadium in Casablanca. Al Ahly of Egypt are record 10-time CAF Champions League winners and the current title holders. They came second in their group before beating Raja of Morocco 3-2 on aggregate in the quarterfinal. The reigning champions then defeated ES Satif of Algeria 6-2 on aggregate to reach the final. Meanwhile, Wydad of Morocco are 2-time Africa champions, with their most recent title being in 2017. Wydad topped their group before beating CR Belouizdad of Algeria 1-0 on aggregate in the quarterfinal, before ousting Petro de Luanda in the semifinal 4-2 on aggregate. And the draw for the African Nations Championship Algeria 2022 was held on Thursday in Cairo, Egypt. Algeria, already qualified as host nation, will be waiting for the other qualified teams for the final tournament. Libya and Morocco are automatically qualified in the northern zone as they were the only teams to engage. In athletics, let's look at the highlights at the Wonder Diamond League meeting in Eugene, Oregon, in the USA. On Saturday, US's Michael Norman set a Diamond League 400-meter record of 43.60 to beat Granada's Kirani James and Matthew Hudson-Smith, who broke the British record with 44.35. Kenya's Faith Kipyegon took the women's 1,500 meters in commanding fashion. The Olympic champion came home a clear winner in a world lead and meeting record of 3 minutes 52.59 seconds. Ethiopia's Gudai Segai got second in 3 minutes 54.21, with Canada's Gabriel Debus Stafford third in 3 minutes 58.62 seconds. Barihu Aregawi took the men's 5,000 meters in a meeting record and world lead of 12 minutes 50.05 seconds, coming home well clear of fellow Ethiopians Samuel Tafera and Salomon Barega. In the men's 400-meter hurdles, Brazil's Alisson dos Santos clocked a world-leading 47.23 to come home a distant winner ahead of US's Khalifa Rosa and Quincy Hall, who both clocked personal bests of 48.10. Jamaica's Shelly Ann Fraser-Pryce was a clear winner of the women's 200 meters in 22.41, with USA's Brittany Brown second in 22.74 and Anthonique Strachan of Bahamas third in 22.76. Sweden's Kadi Sagna had a personal best of 6.95 meters to take victory in the women's long jump, with Nigeria's Ese Brume second with 6.82 meters and USA's Tara Davis coming third with 6.73 meters. Nora Geruto, the Kenyan-born athlete who now represents Kazakhstan, won the women's 3,000 meters triple chase in 8 minutes 57.97 seconds, a world lead. Bahrain's Winfred Mutile Yavi was close behind in second, while Ethiopia's Medikos Abebe was third. And that's it for this edition of Netland Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under-Secretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. At the recent meetings in Davos, Switzerland, many statesmen, heads of state, business people attended, and they made very sincere remarks at the seat. And the characteristic of these remarks was that they reflect the narrative that we have all become familiar with in the media about the Russia war in Ukraine. However, on the last days, a statement was made by Professor Kissinger, who became later a national security advisor and then Secretary of State under President Nixon, and also President Ford. Dr. Kissinger, who is now 98, could be called the guru of studies of geopolitics. He was able to influence an earlier generation of geopolitical experts. He published two books among his writings that are central for consideration at this time. His first book is the product of his dissertation, which was converted to a book called A World Restored, which is a careful study of the Napoleonic Wars and measures to end it that culminated in the Vienna Congress of 1815. He also wrote a book for the nuclear age, the book was a product of a study organized by the Rockefeller Foundation, and the book was called Nuclear Weapons and Foreign Policy, Bringing Us to the Nuclear Age. These are books which really influence an earlier generation of geopoliticians. It is also true to note that Dr. Kissinger, as a practitioner, became familiar with negotiations, first in Vietnam, where he was criticized a great deal for the expansion of the war outside of Vietnam into Cambodia, and also introduced in the Middle East step-by-step diplomacy, which I can say was at variance with what the United Nations was producing, was a comprehensive solution in the Middle East. So he understands the essence of what a stable world order should be. And it's in this context that I think one can safely say that it is misleading to assert that a rule-based international order was created by the Western powers. It is true that when the book of Kissinger was written and they talked about restoring world order, it was a Eurocentric world order, because at that time, most of Africa, Asia, and Latin America were colonies of few European powers. But then we must notice also that even after that world was restored, it was decided by the leaders of the European countries in the Berlin Conference to partition Africa without the consent of the African people. When the table order that was created in 1815 collapsed during the First World War, 1914 to 1918, European statesmen met at the Versailles Conference. This time, the United States, which had been absent from consideration in the old world order, came into play. At the Conference of Versailles, the leaders of Europe, of England, France, and the United States in particular, signed the Covenant of Nations and established an institution called the League of Nations to assist states to maintain the peace. Regrettably, that world order also collapsed in 1939 at the outbreak of the Second World War. By 1944, when that war was coming to an end, British and American experts met in the United States at Dumbarton, and they tried to see what would be the new formulation of a new world order. They formulated what was called the Dumbarton proposals. Although Russia or the Soviet Union was part of the ally, Stalin did not look carefully about those proposals until, and this is important to bear in mind, in February 1945 at Yalta, Stalin became interested about the formulation of the new world order. He made tremendous contribution to the membership of the new United Nations, and particularly with the voting patterns in the Security Council. It was also that conference that brought in both France and China that formed today the five permanent members of the Security Council. But we must also take into account that at the San Francisco Conference, which was trying to see how to formulate the Dumbarton proposals to a charter of the United Nations, the Latin American delegations played a very crucial role. It is because of their dogged insistence that regional arrangements were placed in the charter, what today we have as Chapter 8 of the United Nations Charter. But then there were others too who contributed to a stable world order. As the African states, Asian states, became fully independent, the African states in particular tried to influence what is a just and stable world order. They fought hard with their allies in the Third World to abolish all forms of colonialism, and they succeeded. They also pushed for the end of racism and pronounced human rights as very crucial. And they also were successful. So the question of ending colonialism and having human rights became part of Africa, Asia, Third World contribution to the formulation of a global world order. But that's not even the end. As the United Nations was functioning, attentions were placed also to economic matters. And here, Latin America played a crucial role. They formulated the question of development and trade. And UNCTAD, the United Nations on Trade and Development, played a role. In fact, the truth is that WTO was a transformation from UNCTAD. This is why it is not fruitful to talk about the world order being created by Europe. The rule-based international order is a multilateral effort, and this should be recognized by all. But also, the United Nations members have not only accepted the charter as the basis of a stable world order, they also are worried that many powers are selective with their honoring of the principles of the charter. And that should be the major concern now when we are looking at the war in Ukraine. We do not know what form it will take, but we should bear in mind then a major principle which Dr. Kissinger drew from his study of the Napoleonic era. And it is this. It states that any state or group of states for that matter that insists in an absolute security for itself condemns all other states to absolute insecurity, which is a recipe for instability, and that may lead to a revolutionary state. This should be kept in mind. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent.
No be the thing will make me fall for him. Okay. I dey feel like a queen when I dey ride by inside. Any day, anytime I go be him ride or die. Yeah. Make that bust your mind. If you could give me only salary, oh. Money dey, he know dey, he dey cool my mind. I be perfect, then over ten.
Keys I feel. She's a queen, but a freak, her lips a machine. That's a wife and a side chick to me. You know, say, we can't go nowhere. My woman, 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 my woman. She give me peace of mind. She not go waste my time.
I love my mom.
kama perfume ya warrior. Imeprove sio softy ni bondia. Wezi angusha ata kijaribu kudandia. Hinge sweet love wachana na hizo bandia. Umenipea watoto na ito mami. Na bado na joto la mimba papi. Teno kani launch come sign me. Diana Biboruga mitandao na jami. Unichore, lakini hukumeza pasha kachi budi. Ukawacha waonge, wajione. Ukapandisha mapenzi kalongi ya mpongole. Real love ni hodari. Imenijenga utadhani matofari. Sweet love zuchu huita sukari. Kitu freshi si kitu fokodhari.
Esika ya la rendezvous, esika ma balle salamaka, esika. Africa ya matumi.
And that was our Sunday Music Spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here, the English service of the Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, including producer Saida Hamdoun, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, the fall of a dry leaf is a warning to the green ones. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.